compound. Yisrael Ariel was the chief rabbi of a settlement in the Egyptian Sinai called Yamit, and he blessed a suicide plot of young settlers to barricade themselves inside a bunker and threaten to commit suicide in order to prevent the evacuation of Israeli settlements from the Egyptian Sinai. The only way that was actually stopped is the Israeli government flew in Meir Kahana, the top fanatical rabbi, the top extremist rabbi in the country, who's actually from Brooklyn, and basically negotiated with these young settlers to come out of the bunker. But Yisrael Ariel was the only rabbi who would agree to their suicide plot for these young men to kill themselves inside this bunker.
And we asked Dan if it was true that Ariel was involved in a plot to demolish Al-Aqsa.
Yisrael Ariel was found to be leading a plot of young men to dig a tunnel into the Al-Aqsa compound so they could take it over. They thought they would tunnel in the night, go up on top of the compound, and they believed they would take it over and destroy the Dome of the Rock and the mosque. That was found out, and Yisrael Ariel decided then that instead of radical vigilante action, the way to accomplish his apocalyptic goals was through the education ministry, that he would have basically an ideological revolution in Israeli society. And so that's when he founded the Temple Institute. The Temple Institute began to receive money from the education ministry as early as in the 1980s, with the explicit goal of destruction of the Al-Aqsa compound, building of a temple, and conversion of Israel, which is an ethnocratic state, into a full-on genocidal theocracy.
I mean, David, the Al-Aqsa is one of the holiest sites in the Islamic faith, isn't it? I mean, can you imagine a site of similar significance to any other faith actually being desecrated in this way and then being virtually ignored by the international community?
Well, it's hard to imagine, isn't it, that this could happen to a Buddhist or Hindu or Christian institution, certainly not to Jewish institutions. And it's a mark of the way in which Islamophobia is encoded into the hard DNA of the Zionist movement, and that they want to assault the Islamic faith, not just Al-Aqsa, but the Islamic faith in general and its followers. But it's not only Muslims that they are opposed to. We can see also in Jerusalem what's been happening in relation to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, one of the most holy shrines of the Christian religion, where mourners have equally been attacked by Israeli forces who've been tear gassed and have been refused access to the church over Easter. And so that we should recall it's not just Islam that they have a problem with. It's also other religions that are not Judaism. But Islam is the first amongst equals of the bad religions in their book.
Yes, indeed. Well, we then asked Dan about how the temple movement interacted with the settler movement since the 1980s.
Since the 1980s, when the temple movement began this idea of taking over Israeli society, this was at the same time that the settler movement in general began its takeovers of Israeli society. So as the temple movement becomes more prominent and this desire to destroy Al-Aqsa and build a temple becomes more prominent in the Israeli settler movement, the Israeli settler movement was taking over Israeli society in a very carefully crafted plan and strategy that saw them take the levers of power. So that's essentially what the temple movement's impact on Israeli society is today.
I mean, David, you know, the Israeli regime claims that it doesn't support the destruction of Al-Aqsa, yet it's funding an organization that does. I mean, can Muslim governments around the world trust the Israeli regime's stated position on this, do you think?
Well, of course not. The short answer to that is no, they can't. But what's really significant here is the way in which the Israeli regime has been increasingly subverting its professed positions in, for example, directly supporting the Temple Institute. And it shows the way in which the credibility of the Zionist regime in relation to settlements, in relation to Al-Aqsa, in relation to all the matters of concern to the Palestinians, is a position which is there for public consumption, to try and pretend that they are interested in some way in a Palestinian state. I mean, clearly nonsense, and they show that by their actions in practice.
Well, we then asked Dan to tell us about other Israeli politicians who've been outspoken in their support for this movement.
There are dozens and dozens of political figures, including elected officials inside Israel, who have been explicit about their support for Zionist designs on the Al-Aqsa compound, not only limited to the far right, the apocalyptic Zionists, right, we could call them, but also among the Likud, which has basically become a temple party as a result of a carefully crafted strategy by a member of parliament named Moshe Feiglin, who is essentially a disciple of Meir Kahana. You also see this increasingly in the last several years in the liberal parties in Israel expressing support for Israeli sovereignty over the Al-Aqsa compound, saying that, you know, we must control it. We should have Israel should have full security control. And also they use the trope of prayer rites at the Al-Aqsa compound.
And finally, we asked Dan to tell us about the prohibition on Orthodox Jews praying in Al-Aqsa and how that's been abolished.
It is completely forbidden in Orthodox Judaism to step foot onto the Temple Mount. It's a sin considered so grave that it is punishable by a divinely imposed death sentence. It is one of the most grave sins in Judaism there is, because basically this site is considered so holy that to show deference to it is to stay away from it. However, Zionism sees this site as a place of conquest, as a place to be conquered, as a site to be conquered. And so as Zionism has shifted to the right, more and more regular, everyday Zionists see this not in religious terms, but in nationalist terms, that this Al-Aqsa compound, what they call the Temple Mount, is a place that, because they believe they're in a Jewish state, that Jews should have rights to.
David, you know, many people were surprised when Tommy Robinson attended a demonstration with Zippy Hotevelli, who's a supporter of the Temple movement, as you know. But as we've revealed, I mean, Robinson's employer was also funded by Henry Sweker, who backs the Temple movement. I mean, what other overlaps exist between the settler movement and Islamophobia around the world?
Well, there is a very striking overlap between those organizations in the US and indeed in the UK who are funding settlements, funding the IDF and similar activities, and those organizations who they're also funding, which are Islamophobic. So the Islamophobic network of the key organizations in the US and the UK, the Henry Jackson Society in the UK perhaps, or the Middle East Forum, or the David Horowitz Center in the US, they are also funded by the same organizations which fund the settlements. So it's a very, very close and tight-knit overlap between those two sets of organizations, and that's because they share the same objective: settlement in Palestine and anti-Muslim prejudice elsewhere.
Mm. And I just wondered if you could say what your thoughts are about how the Zionist occupation forces are treating Palestinian Christians in Jerusalem.
Well, we've seen this over Easter this year, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is one of the key holy sites in Christianity. And Palestinian Christians attempting to go to pray there have been attacked by the police and by the military. They've had tear gas and rubber bullets shot at them. And so we see what's going on here. It's not to do with the hostility to Christianity or Islam in general, although there is that. It's also to do with the fact that these people are Palestinians. They don't want the Palestinians to have any rights whatsoever. And of course, this is in the context of occupation, where the Israelis are the occupying power, and where these effectively are war crimes, and they are committing these day and daily with a really very little response in the international media.
Well, we'll just pause the discussion there for a moment and have a look at this report on the creation of International Quds Day and its impact on the resistance movement to Zionism today.
In the week of commemoration of International Quds Day, we see continued incursions on Al-Aqsa Mosque by occupation forces and settler colonialists. As the attacks intensify, Quds Day reminds us of the history of the efforts to unite the resistance in Palestine and beyond to the Zionist entity. The decision to mark Quds Day, adopted by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, not long after the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979, was aimed at highlighting the approach of the Revolutionary Republic towards the Palestinian struggle. That approach was to challenge the ruling hegemony of the US and the Western countries and to call for unification of the Muslim world against their influence. At the time, Khomeini saw Iran had developed an unprecedented dependence on the US and the West, and its close ties with Israel under the Shah were a crucial element of that relationship. Picking that relationship apart and fostering what's become today's axis of resistance has been a significant achievement of this process. For example, Hamas stated in 2019 that International Quds Day has restored the credibility of the occupied Quds as the first Qibla, or direction of the Muslims. A Hamas representative also stated, "The Islamic Republic of Iran has always emphasized the importance of the role of the young people in supporting the issue of Palestine and opposing the occupation." Saeed Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah's Secretary General, opened the Solidarity Convention for the support of the Intifada in Beirut on May the 22nd, 2001, with the words, "We share the same destiny with the Palestinian Intifada till the liberation of Jerusalem." The first Quds conference was held in Beirut to support the Palestinian Intifada. It led to the establishment of the Quds Foundation, with headquarters in Beirut, the capital of liberation and victory. The foundation was subsequently listed as a terrorist entity by the U.S. Department of the Treasury, an indication of the importance of Quds Day in the minds of the enemies of Palestine. Fittingly, it's Zionist groups who present as defenders of the Jews, but in reality act directly for the Zionist entity, who are at the forefront of today's attack on Quds Day, such as the Community Security Trust and the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism in the UK, or the Anti-Defamation League in the United States. The attacks show that the Zionists fear a united resistance.
David, what does the campaign against Quds Day in the West consist of, and who's it led by?
Well, the campaign consists of attempts to denounce Quds Day demonstrations in the UK or Canada or France or Germany or the US as being somehow anti-Semitic. And these are led by organisations which have a formal mission to defend Jews from anti-Semitism and racism, but whose actual mission is to blur the lines between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, to pretend that anti-Zionism, which of course is what Quds Day expresses, is the same as or very similar to anti-Semitism. So then these are groups which of course have direct relationships to the Israelis. The ADL in the US, the Anti-Defamation League, has been working very closely with the FBI and indeed with the Mossad since the 1940s, since even before the formal creation of the Mossad, and the CST in this country, Community Security Trust, also has trained with and been trained by the Mossad. So it's very clear that there's a close relationship there with the State of Israel.
Do you think there's a wider international context to the development of a collaborative resistance which Quds Day's helped to develop?
I think when you see the phrase, the axis of resistance, it refers to an axis in the Levant and in the Middle East. But what we see today in the reshaping of the world and the geopolitics, the Russian intervention in the Ukraine, and what that means in terms of the relationships between countries in the axis of resistance, for example, and China and Russia and India and even other countries like Brazil, we see an emerging multipolarity. And Quds Day, in a way, has helped to bring that closer together because it's shown how collaboration can work and how collaboration makes the enemy fear what your togetherness.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there because, unfortunately, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So, until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وهو الذي خلق من الماء بشرا فجعله نسبا وصهرا وكان ربك قديرا
And it is he who has created from semen a human being and made him a relative by lineage and marriage. And ever is your Lord competent concerning creation.
Dear listeners, we were discussing the 54th verse of Surah Al-Furqan. وَهُوَ الَّذِي خَلَقَ مِنَ الْمَاءِ بَشَرًا فَجَعَلَهُ نَسَبًا وَصِحْرًا وَكَانَ رَبُّكَ قَدِيرًا And he it is who has created man from water. Then he made him related in blood and in wedlock, and your Lord is ever powerful. As you may remember, the previous verses were also discussing the Almighty Allah's blessings, and the different forms of his mercies, the showers of mercies on the servants, and the benefits of the rains as well. So the Almighty Allah talked about different kinds of waters and different benefits of them. And in this verse, another aspect of water is brought up. وَهُوَ الَّذِي خَلَقَ مِنَ الْمَاءِ بَشَرًا He has created a man from water also. We concluded that since the other verses suggest the purpose of water here is the sperm from which all people are generated by Allah's might. فَجَعَلَهُ نَسَبًا وَصِهْرًا, and he made him related in blood and wedlock. We also said that these two are talking about the indirect cause in the subject of marriage. In chapter Nisa, seven of the unmarriageable ones, the mother, daughter, sister of mother, sister of father, daughter of brother, daughter of sister, that are created by lineage or parentage are mentioned, and also four cases of the indirect cause, daughter of wife, mother of wife, wife of issue, and wife of father are mentioned. Of course, there are other opinions about this sentence stated by commentators, but this one is stronger and clearer, including this one. Some say that the word nasab means male offspring, and the word sihr means female offspring, because blood relationships traditionally are counted depending on fathers and not mothers. But as we said earlier in this program and in the previous episode, the other verses of the Holy Quran suggest that this verse is talking about the different subjects of marriage. And also, other verses of the Holy Quran, specifically the 61st verse of chapter Ali Imran, suggests that if we believe that blood relationships are counted only depending on fathers, it is a big mistake, and it is originated from the customs and the traditions that were before Islam. These traditions thought that blood relationship has been originated only from father, and mother has no role. But as it is specified by Islam jurisprudence and all the Islam learned persons, all ordinances that are about lineally being unmarriageable are from both the father's side and the mother.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
It is interesting that there is a famous tradition which is recorded in Shi'i and Sunni books. According to this tradition, this verse is sent down about the Prophet, peace be upon him and his progeny, and Imam Ali alayhi salam, because the Prophet ﷺ married his daughter Fatima off to Ali alayhi salam, and therefore Ali was both the cousin of the Prophet and the spouse of his daughter. This is the meaning of the Quranic phrase نَسَبًا وَصِحْرًا, related in blood and in wedlock. But as we have repeatedly mentioned, these narrations are some clear extensions of the verse. These different meanings mentioned by the commentators do not prevent the generality of the meaning of the verse. This verse includes any relationship that is created by the way of blood and marriage, and one of its clear extensions is the bilateral relationship of Ali alayhi salam and the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. And at the end of the verse, in order to put emphasis on the former issues, the Quran says, وَكَانَ رَبُّكَ قَدِيرًا, and your Lord is ever powerful. Your Lord is the one who has created all different kinds of people from this very simple water. He created life from water. He enlivened the earth by this water. He lets you live on the earth using this water and its enlivening effects, and he made you yourselves also from a kind of water. So that is why you have to believe in the power of your Lord. وَكَانَ رَبُّكَ قَدِيرًا, and your Lord is ever powerful. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ وَبَرَكَاتُهُ.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Revolution of this martyr nurturing nation towards a state of indifference and inertness, heedless of the fact that an uprising is staged for the sake of Allah and based upon faith and spirituality will never lose ground. Our people have now become accustomed to martyrdom and sacrifice in the way of Islam, in the path of Islam. They do not fear any enemy, any power, or any plot. The people whose doctrine is devoid of martyrdom are the ones who are afraid. Calculators, with all their claims, had not understood the Islamic revolution, which had emanated from the pure heart of a nation and was mingled with the source of the people and their faith and belief.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini. Since we are striving for the taqwa and we are trying to gain taqwa through stopping ourselves from performing any kind of bad deeds, any kind of sins, and on top of that, we are taking care of our prayers, our actions. We are trying to purify ourselves. When we are purifying ourselves, therefore, Imam Khomeini says that speech will be effective when it comes from a purified heart. This is important that Imam Khomeini is saying that if someone has a purified heart, if someone's soul is purified, definitely he talks out of truth. He never follows the falsehood. And therefore, when he follows the truth, his speech is effective. His speech will have the effect. And therefore, we have this famous saying that al-alimu bil-amal, that a scholar, a knowledgeable person is the one who talks out of practice. When he practices something that he says means that he has purified himself, he says the truth. And we have seen that many scholars, many jurists who were at a place where they were, for example, delivering the speech or they were the teachers teaching the subjects, they used to say that they would never say anything which they were not performing or they were not practicing for at least 40 days. Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi. Sallallahu alayhi. Salli ala For example, if someone was about to say to people that you must pray the nighttime prayer, which is Salat al-Tahajjud or Salat al-Layl or Namaz al-Tahajjud in Persian, they refer to this Namaz al-Tahajjud. So they used to practice it for 40 days. And after that, they used to say to these people. Therefore, it shows that when their heart was purified, when they truly has accepted something, then they used to say it. And this is important that the purified heart means that what you are from your inside, you should be in the same way outside. Whatever you have your inside, you should look the same from outside. Whatever beliefs you have, whatever you practice, you need to be clear with the people. You need to be something that you're from inside. And that's what purified heart means. And therefore, Imam Khomeini says that speech will be effective when it comes from a purified heart, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, every night and every day. Insight. Good evening and welcome to this episode of Insight. It is 60 years now that the U.S. has imposed economic sanctions on Cuba. We will be discussing this issue and other issues related to Cuba in a conversation with Alberto Gonzalez Casals, Cuba's ambassador to Iran. But first, this brief analysis.
We recently witnessed the large amount of sanctions that the US and Europe imposed on Russia following its invasion of Ukraine. We're also very familiar with the US and Western sanctions that have been imposed on Iran in the last 43 years following the Islamic Revolution that overthrew the US-backed Pahlavi dictatorship in Iran. However, many forget that this year it will be 60 years that the US has imposed an embargo and economic sanctions on Cuba following the Cuban Revolution that overthrew the US-backed Batista dictatorship in that island nation. If we look at history, we see that the conflict between Cuba and the US did not begin with the Cuban Revolution, but goes back to the beginnings of the United States and the Monroe Doctrine, which declared the Western Hemisphere to be America's sphere of influence or backyard, and that the US would not tolerate foreign powers being present in that region, declaring this mainly to European colonial states which had colonies in the Americas. This was particularly true of the island of Cuba, which was a Spanish colony located less than 100 miles from the US mainland. From the very beginning of the United States, plans for the conquest or purchase of Cuba from Spain were made in various administrations. During the time preceding the American Civil War, Southern slave states made efforts to stoke war with Spain in order to annex Cuba and add it to the list of slave states at a time when new states in the American West were being added to the US territory, most of which were free, non-slave states. Finally, in 1898, the imperialist factions in the US were successful in igniting a war with Spain. Following Spain's defeat, the US formally declared Cuba to be a US protectorate, as well as receiving Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines from Spain. The United States granted Cuba the appearance of independence in 1902, but imposed a constitution on Cuba that gave power over Cuban foreign and economic affairs to the United States, and even gave the US the right to intervene militarily at its own discretion, which it did on numerous occasions, including the occupation of the famous Guantanamo Bay, in which the US maintains a naval base, and which is the notorious site of the illegal detention and torture of hundreds of people that the US has kidnapped in its so-called War on Terror since 2001. This was followed by years of the United States backing the Batista dictatorship, in which Cuba became the center of criminal activities of the American mafia, particularly money laundering, gambling, and prostitution, where the Batista regime was paid off from the profits of these criminal activities in order for the mafia to continue these activities. Following the revolution, the Cuban government, under the leadership of Fidel Castro, sided with the Soviet Union in the Cold War, leading to the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 and Cuba's active involvement in many wars of liberation and decolonization in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, further enraging US leaders. If the US excuse to impose sanctions on Cuba throughout the Cold War was Cuba's backing of the Soviet Union, the continuation of the sanctions after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and its continuation until today by every US administration, shows that maybe the real reason for the imposition of US sanctions has always been that US elites want to punish Cubans for their independence and to let this serve as a warning to other nations in Latin America and around the world who would want to follow this example. Despite the countless assassinations, coup d'etats, and dirty tricks that the United States conducted throughout the world, it has, for 60 years, miserably failed to overthrow the Cuban Revolution, and Cubans have been able to reach high levels of human development and are now among the most advanced nations in medicine and biotechnology, and among the few nations who successfully developed their own line of COVID vaccines despite these sanctions, which deprive Cuba of its largest natural market for its products and services. Given the rapidly changing global environment and the powerful non-Western and anti-US alliances that are forming in the 21st century, it might become easier for Cuba to exist as an independent, revolutionary nation in the next 60 years, in a future where it will matter less if the US imposes or does not impose sanctions on a nation, even a nation that is located so close to the United States.
Ambassador Casals, thank you very much for joining us on Insight. As you know, the program tries to look at the issues from a historic and strategic perspective. We have taken the occasion of the 60 years of U.S. sanctions on Cuba to have a conversation with you today about the history of Cuba, about the different things that are happening there in Cuba and in the region in Latin America, but also Cuba's relations with Iran. And we would like to ask you to please share some of your insight into these matters. And before we get to the historic issues, let's start talking about the sanctions. So, as you know, Iran has been sanctioned for 43 years. We were, until very recently, the world champions of American sanctions. This is now, this honor has now been given to the Russians. They are now starting to get it. But the country that has been the most sanctioned in history is Cuba for 60 years. Some might say that it is not worth the trouble for the independence. Some countries want to be independent. They are willing to accept sanctions. Some countries, no, they don't care. They will do what the Americans say and get all the different consumer products that they think the people want. So I would like to ask you in this way. Is it worth it to suffer under the sanctions and have independence? Or is it better to do what the Americans say and have all the consumer products that you want?
Yes, of course. Thank you so much, my friend, to having me in your program. And thank you so much to Press TV, to all your teams, for this opportunity to address to the audience, to the Press TV. Regarding the sanctions, as you say, of course, Cuba, we have the number one sanction from the United States. Only in the last period of this person's named Trump in the United States, they got only 244 measures against Cuba, sanctions against Cuba. They get the worst situation for Cuba and the worsening in this moment. We don't have difference now in this moment with the Biden administrations that's supposed to be as another kind of administration. They will change something in Cuba or regarding Cuba or toward Cuba. But nothing changed by the moment. We said more or less that it could be in the same situation we have. And the people of Cuba are suffering, of course, and our economy is suffering in a very hard situations because of the sanctions. There is no any sector, there is no any situations regarding Cuba that is not affected by the sanctions from the United States. Not even no family, no person, even living in Cuba or living overseas, is not affected by the sanctions. All of us are affected one way to another one by the sanctions. Mainly, and the more hard and sensitive, is regarding the medicines and the sector of medicines and the health sector, of course, and affected most a lot. Personally, I have my own experience that one family of mine died because of we cannot get in the proper way one medicines from the lab from the United States. They denied, due to the law of the embargo, to facilitate these medicines to the Cuban people. And so my personal way, I need to suffer a loss from in my family. And like me, many people in Cuba, we have many situations regarding the health sector, the food sector, agricultural sector, because anything is under sanctions on Cuba. Even if you import any kind of goods that have at least 10%, only 10%, building in America, this is under sanction for these situations. And as you said, but we have 60 years in these conditions, and it's getting run, and we will continue in that situation if they don't want. It's not Cuba who blocked the United States. It's not Cuba who affect the economy of the United States. It's not Cuba who make a sanction to the United States and nobody in the United States. So it's not in our size, the solutions. They need to get conscious about it and to get, this is all politics, this is obsolete politics, this is illegal politics that they toward to us. Of course, the sanction from the United States isn't only because of the United States. It's because of there is some people too, or some countries that support the United States in many ways. So the United States not only can't put the sanctions because it could be almost impossible regarding the economy, a global economy, but in the people follow the conditions from the sanctions in the United States, of course, affect to us in the same way. We will continue, of course. It's more important for us, the moral that we have in front of the world. We are a hope. We resist, and we will continue to resist. We have 60 years. We will have 60 years more. If they want to continue to do it, it's their own problem. They affected, too, not only the Cuban people. They affected, too, the American people. They prohibit, even against your own law, prohibit the American to visit Cuba. Cuba is the only country, by law in the United States, that they cannot visit. Even they could visit, American could visit any place that they could be dangerous, and pay place like war or something like that. But Cuba, only 90 miles from the coast of the United States, they cannot visit Cuba.
A lot of families.
At least legally point of view. And the point of view of the family, too. They affect to the family, the Cuban family that live in the United States and the Cuban family. They divide the families of the Cuban family there. And they don't take care about that. They have emptied their embassy in Havana. We still have the relationship. We promote the normal relationship between Cuba and the government of the United States. But even they quit the consulate. The American consulate in Havana is practically not working in this moment. So the Cuban people need to go to so far like Guyana or some another place to obtain the consular topics and consular procedures to get to the United States and to get the visa. After that, staying there in Guyana, in many ways, they deny the visa for the Cuban who went there. And so the Cuban people, sometimes they get illegally entered into the United States. They promote the legal way to get migrations to the United States. They broke the talks that we have in migration topics that it affected in this kind of way. And later than that, they condemn us because the people want to go to the United States due to the situations in Cuba. So they block us. They make a sanction to our economy. They don't allow the normal people to make the consular affair. They make a lot of things against Cuba and the Cuban people. Then they decide this is an internal problem. So it's not because of that. It's because of it is the American that they consider that they are the police in the world, and they not consider to have in the proper way the normal behavior as a neighbor. We want a normal relationship with the United States, but not under conditions and with all respect to our sovereignty. And answer your question, of course, we will continue to resist until this moment.
Great. With your permission, I want to now get to Iran-Cuba relations.
Yes.
Of course, our Iran-Cuba relations became much stronger after the revolution in Iran.
Yep.
We even had, among the revolutionaries in Iran, contacts with Cuba before the revolution. Mm-hmm. So this contact goes even further back. Mm-hmm. Before the establishment of the Islamic Republic. But then when it happened, of course, Cuba was one of the main countries that supported the revolution in the international fora. Mm-hmm. We had very interesting and nice things that were said at that time by the leadership of Cuba, by Fidel Castro and other leaders, in terms of advising some of the things that we might want to do at the beginning of the revolution in terms of establishing our
various revolutionary organs and organizations. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of interesting stories about that, that people who are interested might want to go look that up. We also had the state visit by President Castro.
Yes.
That very famous state visit where him and Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, had a very interesting and long discussion and meeting. Mm-hmm. We've had recently Iranian Vice President for Economic Affairs, going to the inauguration of Daniel Ortega in mm-hmm. Managua, and that big meeting that was there, mm-hmm. including meeting with President Diaz-Canel. They had a meeting there. Mm-hmm. We had the meeting of the foreign ministers in New York at the General Assembly in September.
Yes.
So because of our revolutionary background, because of some of the things that you mentioned in terms of having the same problems with the Americans and the sanctions, we've had very good relations. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe most interestingly, very recently, we had the co-production of the COVID vaccine, Soberana,
yep.
between the Finley Institute in Cuba and Pasteur Institute in Tehran. And basically, the thing that I think is interesting for people to understand is that Iran and Cuba are actually biotech, very, mm-hmm. very strong biotech countries mm-hmm. that are independent yep. from the global pharmaceutical, you know, whatever you want to call it.
That's, yes, yes.
We are able to produce our own medicines and able to give it to other countries that mm-hmm. need it, that might not have this. So if you could please talk a little bit about that aspect, this very successful cooperation that we recently had for the vaccine, and then we can get to other issues regarding Iran-Cuba relations.
Yes, my friend. Of course, the relationship between Cuba and Iran is so strong. Political point of view, and we try to improve that in point of view, economical point of view. We said that it's not the same level, the political relationship we have and the economical relationship. Of course, they have their own causes because of the embargoes of both country and the blockade. It's difficult sometimes. We are so far, and of course, but we are promoting the best conditions in a commercial and economical relationship. And that one that you mentioned regarding the cooperations in biotechs is one of the most good example about it regarding this this matter, no? And we are moving forward. Let me tell you something before. Many people said, or some people in the world said, I heard about it, that the relationship, the strong relationship between Cuba and Iran is due to they have the common enemy. Mm-hmm. It's not that, only that. Mm-hmm. Without the United States or not, take into account the culture, the idiosyncrasy, the stronger behavior of both countries, always we will be friends. Both countries will need to be friends because we have good people, we have friendly and hospitality people on both sides, not because of we have a common enemy. That, of course, is coming in the same way. But back to the this cooperation we have in this matter of the vaccines, of course. You know that leader, Fidel Castro, at that moment promoted that Cuba need to be people from scientists. And they promote a lot the development of the biotechs in Cuba. That's the result we have now. And of course, we are in the best position to cooperate and to share our success with our friends. First, with our friends, of course, like Iran. And talking about the embargoes and these kind of things, I always said that sometimes we need to thank these sanctions, because without the sanctions, maybe these great scientific people, like Pasteur Scientific and the Finlay Scientific, maybe could not meet if we don't have the sanction. We find in the proper way to try to cooperate in this, in both sides. I don't know if we use it at that moment without sanction, Pfizer vaccine or something. No, we are using our own vaccines. Cuba has 5 vaccines in this moment, and we cooperate with Iran. They have their own vaccines, and they produce their own vaccines, and we are promoting to vaccinate our people and to have in the proper way. But not only in these fields of COVID, we are cooperating in many other fields in biotechs in different ways, even the pneumococcus vaccines. Mm-hmm. That pneumococcus vaccines in all the world is expensive, even in the hands of the West country in the high level, and they sell this kind of vaccine in a very high cost for that. And we are cooperating to produce our own vaccine. I mean, Iran and Cuba, to produce our own vaccine against pneumococcus, and we will facilitate in this kind. That's the best way to do it. The president, His Excellency President Raisi, during my meeting with him, introduced my credential to him, he told me something very real. The best way to overthrow the sanctions against our country is to cooperate each other, to stay together each other and with the unity of each other. And that's really, that's this cooperation shows this kind of success that we have. It's amazing. I am really impressed with the potential of the economy, the potential of scientists, the potential of the everything that you have, even in the economy for food and everything that you have here. And you produce on your own resource. That's the best. And that's the best conditions that you are making a lot.
Yes, I think, Mr. Ambassador, this COVID epidemic showed that, unfortunately, the world, in terms of medicine and in terms of these things, in the hands of some big corporations
yes.
that control the government, that you don't know, we know so many people are having so many side effects from the vaccines that were rushed in America to quickly get them out. So many people are having heart attacks and all these problems. The vaccines in Iran and Cuba, nobody has having any problems.
Yep.
So I think this is a very important thing for humanity. It's not only simply because we want, you know, our countries to because medicine is not like another product. It's something that's a necessity for humanity, and some people just don't have the money for it. So I think this is very important that what you're mentioning in terms of the cooperation in terms of medicine and biotech, both countries are actually, we could say, powers when it comes to medicine and biotech. In a global situation, and coming together and doing that would be very good. So with that in mind, I want to maybe go a little deeper and ask you that if I were to ask you, what would it take for Iran to establish a strategic depth in Cuba? What would it take for Cuba to establish a strategic depth in Iran? Make Iran the place where they can manage their affairs in West Asia. Iran having a base, a friendly base in Latin America. What are the things, in your view, that we could do? I would just reference one small thing. We saw that Iran is able to really project its power to the other side of the world when it came to the issue in Venezuela, as you saw the very severe sanctions that Venezuela had and the hyperinflation. It was basically Iran who helped them save their oil industry, which was lacking because of sanctions. And also we saw consumer goods, Iran opening up very large supermarkets and stores and giving, because as you said, Iran has a very large production of consumer products.
Yes.
One of the things that people criticize, they say Cuba, yes, it's independent, it has its high tech, it has good military and security, but of course the consumer product side is it. So if you could please give us your insight on the ability of these countries, two countries, to establish a strategic depth in each other's countries.
As I told you, our relationship is so strong, and we are ready, and we are in the best conditions to cooperate in many issues in different kind of way. But the main our program and strategy is to develop on ourselves, and that we want from Iran, and maybe Iran want from Cuba too, is to cooperate and to develop on ourselves in this kind of matter. And the case, of course, is really nice, and the conditions that they have in the bilateral relationship within Venezuela and Iran, and they developed the supermarket there. But we want to our own supermarket. We want that the Iran help us to create our own supermarket with our own branch and with the help of Iran, and later we could do it on ourselves. We want the Iran to support us in the energy the topics, but we want to your support, and later we want to do it in our cells in this kind of matter. That's our strategy, the point of view to develop the country, of course. We cannot depend on Iran, and it's not fair to do it. It's not fair to do it, to be in the side of Iran and waiting, because the Iran there, Iran have their own problems, and they have their own situations. That we want is to cooperate in knowledge and know-how, how to do it, we can cooperate, and in both sides too. We want to cooperate like this one, like the vaccines. We issue our, and we share with